Hare Krishna. It's with sheer delight that Sunil Arna and I welcome His Holiness Sri Radhanath Swami, Gaurang Prabhu, Dr. Desai, Radha Krishna Das Prabhuji, and all of you here to our home this evening. We're truly blessed and grateful to have you all here with us. You know, I think I'm totally incompetent to introduce Maharaj, but there's something little which I'd want to share with you. Sunil's been a regular at ISKCON since 83, and I've been somewhat irregular for a long time with ISKCON, but ever since Nupur and Kushal are very dear friends now, but then as complete strangers invited us to their home to spend an evening with Maharaj. And as Maharaj says, we met him for the first time under the moonlight on their terrace. But we say it was magical. I mean, completely from that day, I think, you know, the way he's touched our lives, the way we've felt, you know, a change within ourselves, it's something to experience. You know, it's very difficult to talk about. But, you know, clearly, I would say that, you know, he's given us a guidance and he's made us realize that, you know, there's definitely a need for us to take small steps towards a life which is little less ordinary. Thankful to you, Maharaj, for that. Just, you know, to say a little about Maharaj, his spiritual journey began at the age of 19, while he was on a summer trip to Europe, which culminated into a commitment to search for something more in life. And as a penniless hitchhiker, he traveled through Greece, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and came to India. Initially, he lived in the Himalayas with the forest yogis. You know, after a while, he went and he moved around with a lot of spiritual gurus. He met up with a lot of spiritual practitioners. And finally, he found his path to Vrindavan. And so we finally have him here with us. Apart from being a spiritual light and leader for ISKCON, Maharaj has directed a number of acclaimed social projects, which includes the Midday Meal, which is run by Radha Krishna Das Prabhu, and done a lot of work in terms of setting up missionary hospitals, schools, an orphanage, ashrams, and he's worked on a number of emergency relief programs throughout India as well. And today we request Maharaj to share with us some of his experiences from his spiritual journey, which he so beautifully documented in his book, The Journey Home. And I'm sure you know, each of you would love to hear from Maharaj. Without taking any further time, I would request Maharaj to, you know.
I am very grateful to be with all of you this evening. Very honored to be here. Thank you, Sunil, Anubhuti, Adarna, this beautiful family, for opening the doors to your wonderful home for all of us. It is said that a home where the family centers their life in the principles of Dharma, in devotion to God, that home is Vaikuntha, the spiritual world. When we put this higher principle in the center between us, then all inevitable differences can be overcome, can be transcended. And this is so much a problem in the world today. People have become so obsessed with superficial things and superficial differences that we forget what's actually meaningful and purposeful in life. It is said that in a cultured society, people love people and use things. But unfortunately, all over the world, we find that people love things and use people to somehow or other get them and keep them. It is our tendency to become so obsessed with a quantitative conception of what will make us happy. And we neglect the quality of life. Quantity can never give fulfillment without quality. Because the heart yearns for love. This is the basic principle of life. The need to love and be loved. Things could give some flickering satisfaction to the physical senses and to the mind, but things cannot touch the heart. Only to love and to be loved can give fulfillment within. And according to the Bhagavad Gita, and in fact all the great scriptures of the world, the origin of that truth is the Atma, the eternal living force, the soul. Its natural love for the Supreme Soul, or for God. The Sanskrit word yoga means to reconnect our consciousness with the source of all consciousness. To reconnect the soul with the Supreme Soul, or God, who we call Krishna in the Vedic literatures. In the Bible it is said that the first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And the natural byproduct is you love your neighbor as yourself. The Gita explains it so nicely. Mamaivam so jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. That every living being is a part of God. Aham bija pratapita. That means the Supreme Lord is the mother and the father of all living beings. You cannot love God and not love everyone. We may not like what they do, but we see within ourselves, deeper than just the temporary designations of this body and mind, we see and understand our own essence. The living force is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. When we recognize that within ourselves, then we could also recognize it within all living beings. He said he was a great saint. He had a wife and 10 children. He was a judge, a magistrate under the British rule. He said, the testimony of true love for God is when there is unselfish compassion for all living beings. That's the universal principle of all religion. Religion comes from the Latin word religio. Exactly the same definition as yoga. To reconnect our consciousness with our source. I was asked to speak something about this book that I wrote, The Journey Home, Sunil and Anubhuti. It was their request, so I will try to say something. I was born in Chicago, Illinois. When I was 4 years old, my mother and father brought their three little sons to a village about 30 miles north of Chicago to have a more peaceful, safe life. And everything was there. There was prosperity. There was clean toilets. There were smooth roads, nice highways. But so much struggle. When I was 9 years old, my father went through major bankruptcy. And he struggled like anything. And because of that, even though he worked so hard, and my mother, she was always cutting little coupons out of the newspapers to save 1 cent or 2 cents for whatever she was buying. But the amazing thing is the grace in which they did it. My father would work about 16, 17 hours a day just trying to keep people from taking away our little house. And when he would come home, he would say, "Actually, money isn't so important." He said, "What's really important is our love for each other." And I'd say, "Well, then why are you working all day? You leave at 6 in the morning, you'd come back at midnight." He said, "We have to do it." We have to do it. But it's not what's really important. And my bedroom, I shared it with my little brother, was right next to the only bathroom in our house. And early in the morning, my father, he was struggling like anything. He would always sing a song in the shower. I don't know if this is a tradition in India, but in America, it's the tradition to sing in the shower. Everyone sings in the shower. Even in the movies, they sing in the shower. My father sang this one song, and he sang it with so much feeling. "When April showers come your way, they bring the flowers that bloom in May." The idea of the song is the hardships in life are actually arrangements for something wonderful in the future, if we just see it that way. And he actually saw his bankruptcy. I mean, he really, really lost everything. He really saw that something beautiful is going to come out of this. And something beautiful did come out of it. I became a Swami because I didn't want to get involved in all this stuff. But my father did become a rich man later on. But when I was a teenager, you know, we have our conceptions of America, but the 1960s, the country was torn apart. There was a war in Vietnam. And many of us thought it was a senseless war. And it was a war where every single man, when he reaches 18 years old, is eligible to the draft. When you're drafted, you have two choices: go to war or go to jail. You weren't asked. You were told. There was also the civil rights movement, where a person with dark complexion was condemned to live in the ghettos their whole lives. The Constitution guaranteed freedom, but there was no freedom in the 1950s and 60s. You couldn't go to college. You couldn't get a good job unless it was really an exception. And every day in school, I was told to pledge allegiance to the flag, where we said that this is one nation, indivisible, with freedom and justice for all. Freedom and justice for all. Freedom and justice if you're a certain color. Freedom and justice if you're a certain religion. Freedom and justice even if you're the right, even if you're the majority religion and the majority color, still you're forced to go and fight and probably be killed in a war. Is this freedom and justice? There was a revolution in America. It was called the counterculture, where millions and millions of people in the younger generation revolted against the entire establishment, the government, their parents, everything. There were riots. Cities were burning in the civil rights down. Watts burned down. Newark, New Jersey burned down. There was war everywhere. The counterculture was demonstrating against war, and the U.S. military were shooting and killing their own college students. This is what I grew up as a teenager. I had many questions. By that time, my father was quite well-to-do. And interestingly, 99% of the people who joined the counterculture, of these millions of young people, they all came from middle, upper class, and wealthy families. Something didn't make sense. So I was trying to understand. I saw the words of India's Mahatma Gandhi. Be the change you want to see in the world. And I started to see in my life that the people revolting against hypocrisy were just as hypocritical as the people that they were revolting against. They just had a different hairstyle. In a different dress, we actually made up our own language. It was English, but you would never understand if I talked like we used to talk. It was part of the revolution. We had our own language, we had our own dress code, we had our own everything. And I realized that the real change has to be a change of heart, a change of values. Integrity. So one day, my best friend from childhood, his name was Gary, he called me up. I was in New York City, and he was in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. He said, you have to come here because I need to tell you something. So in those days, I didn't have money. I would hitchhike wherever I was going. So I went to Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and he said that I'm going to Europe to come with me. I said, I don't have any money, and I have a job this summer. Gary said, I don't have any money either. Frank, our common friend, he's going to pay for both of us. So I said, yes, I will go. And a few days later, I was on a $65 flight from New York to Iceland. And then somehow we got a connecting flight from Iceland to Luxembourg. And the first night, we got there in the evening, and the first night we understood how Frank was going to sponsor us. The three of us slept on the ground in a one-man tent. Very tentative. And we were happy, it didn't matter. It was the first time in our lives we were ever outside of our native country of America. We were teenagers. We were very enthusiastic to experience the world, to see how other people think, what they eat, what they think about America, what their conception of God was. We used to read about all these countries. Now we get to actually be there. It was very thrilling. So the first morning, the sun rose, the roosters were crowing, and we went out of the tent, and we found out there was a little waterfall that we could take a shower in. So we went to the waterfall, we returned to the tent, and Frank, he was devastated. We said, "What happened?" He said, "I've been robbed. All our money is gone." We had a return ticket on Icelandic Airlines. He said, "We have to go back. We can't survive with nothing. Let's go." And he started walking. And he looked back. He said, "Let's go." And he walked again. And he looked back. He said, "You're not coming?" And Gary and I, "We've come this far." So he left. And we were hitchhiking from place to place, from Luxembourg to Holland, to Belgium, England. And we were making the scene with young people. Just last year, I was invited to speak in the House of Commons in the British Parliament. And something incredible took place. I was in a room. I was given a subject to speak by the Parliament. They asked me to speak on spirituality and the big society. So I offered a little prayer to my guru and to Krishna. What should I say? And then I looked out the window and I saw the River Thames flowing very slowly. And on the other side of the river, I saw a boundary wall. And I remembered in 1970, 41 years before, all night long I would sit on that boundary wall, looking down at the river, wondering, where is the river of destiny going to lead me? I would look across the river and see the Parliament. And I would see that window, obviously. And now I'm looking at the boundary wall from inside. As a Swami. I didn't even know what a Swami was when I was sitting on that wall. I never heard the word Krishna before when I was sitting on that wall. I had no conception of India. How did all that change? My friend and I, we were going to art museums, to cathedrals, to synagogues, to temples, going to natural scenic places, trying to go deeper in our own spirituality. And eventually, we were living in a cave in a Greek island of Crete. And I would climb a mountain every day and meditate and pray from sunrise to sunset. And my friend, he would go to the seaside and meditate and pray from sunrise to sunset. One day, as the sun was setting, I heard a voice from within my heart. It was a silent voice, but it was the loudest thing I ever heard in my life. Three words were spoken. It stunned me. I knew if I follow this calling, I had to leave everything behind and nothing would ever be the same for me. Go to India. India? I had never met an Indian in my life. I had never eaten Indian food in my life. I had never eaten a chili pepper in my life. I didn't have a map. I didn't have any money to buy a map. But I was committed to go to India. Back to the cave where Gary was sitting in meditation. I said, Gary, something incredible happened to me today. Gary said, something incredible happened to me. I said, what? He said, at sunset, I heard a voice. I said, you heard a voice? He said, yes. I said, what did he say? Gary said, you won't believe me. I said, I will believe you. He said, no, no, you will not believe me. I said, just tell me. He said, I heard a voice. It spoke three words. I said, what were the three words? He says, you're not going to believe me. I said, just tell me. It said, go to is where? He said, I told you you wouldn't believe me. I said, no, no, I didn't hear you. Where? He said, Israel. We should go to Israel. I said, he told me to go to India. India. We were both so shocked. There was total silence for about 20 minutes. And I just looked up at the stars. And I whispered into the sky, coming. And then I said to Gary, at sunrise tomorrow, I'm leaving for India. Usually when we're going on a trip, we have our tickets, we pack our bags. I didn't have any bags. I was living in a cave. I'm leaving for India. Gary was not willing to hitchhike to India. So I left him behind. And the journey home tells about that story. Hitchhiking. My first hitchhiking was, I hitchhiked by asking a boatman, let me work on your boat to get to Athens. And then from there to Thessalonica, to Istanbul, through all of Turkey, through all of Iran, through all of Afghanistan, through Pakistan. From London to the border of India took 6 months. The other day, not the other day, last year actually, I spoke at the University of London. And they asked me to speak about this story. So I had a lot of time. I told some of this story. And afterward, many people bought the book, Journey Home, and were asking me to sign something. And one girl came up to me. She was about 22, British girl. She said, "I really liked your story. Do you know why?" She said, "I am the president of the All UK Hitchhikers Association." She said, "I want to take our group to hitchhike from England to India, the same path that you took." Through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. On the way through France and Italy. And she said, "Can you give us some guidance?" I said, "Yes, I will definitely give you guidance. Take your group and hitchhike to Heathrow Airport. And then take an airplane." What took me 6 months now takes me under 9 hours for the same journey. It's not as life-changing, but it's much safer. I think I aged about 30 years on that journey. There were many dramatic experiences. Near-death experiences, people trying to kill me, getting all kinds of diseases, and so many beautiful people and beautiful things and beautiful, incredible lessons I was learning. One of my first gurus was a mongoose. I'm not going to tell you the story, but if you want to, you could read the book. But this mongoose, he crawled up my back. I had long hair, made my hair into his nest, and went to sleep for 6 hours. And I was a guest at somebody's house. We were on his roof. This was in Kandahar, Afghanistan. And I asked my guest, "Please take this mongoose off my head." And he said, "There is a saying among our people, never wake a sleeping mongoose. Because if you startle a mongoose, he will tear your head into shreds. The ancient Egyptians, they worshipped the mongoose because the mongoose kills the cobra, who is the symbol of death. So my advice to you is do not move until he leaves on his own." He was really heavy. He was literally breaking my neck. Did you ever meet a mongoose? He was curled up. And my friend, he got tired about midnight, and he said, "Excuse me, I must go to sleep." So I was all alone on this rooftop with the mongoose. And he didn't come alone. He had all these insects that started eating my scalp. They were biting and stinging and sucking, and I couldn't move. And I remember thinking, "Why is this happening to me?" And I was praying to God, "God, you know, I'm going on this trip because of you." I'm doing this for you. Why are you doing this to me? The pain was unbearable. It was like a time bomb. And then I asked a question. What am I supposed to learn from this situation? And as soon as I offered a prayer with that question, the thought came in my mind that this mongoose has come to teach me patience. How to be forbearant toward difficulties in our journey and in our purpose in life. And as soon as I met it, the same pain was there. The same danger was there. But I felt totally at peace. I felt totally grateful. This mongoose has come to teach me how to grow. If I'm going to tread this journey, I need to learn patience and forbearance. And about 6 hours later, the mongoose just woke up on his own, and crawled down my back, jumped to the floor, and he looked up at me with his very round, glistening eyes. And he just looked at me, and I looked at him. And it seemed to me that he was smiling. Maybe it was my imagination, but I think he was smiling at me. It was like he was thanking me for a good night's rest. And I was thanking him for teaching me such a good lesson. And then he left. Anyways, many things happened. And finally, I came to the border of India. I was emaciated thin because of so many dysenteries and not much food. I was covered with dust. All my clothes, but I only had one extra set, escaping in Kabul from somebody who was trying to kill me. I had to leave all that behind. There was, in those days, a no man's land between Pakistan and India. From Lahore, I walked miles and miles and miles, and I went into the no man's land, and I was so enthusiastic. With such anticipation, finally, I'm arriving in India, the land of the yogis and the lamas and the gurus and the sages and the Himalayas and the Ganga and the Vedas. I had read so many things, I had so many dreams. My heart was flying across that border. It was the land I was called to. I was trembling with excitement. You see, when things come easy, we usually are not really able to appreciate their value. But when there's a struggle to get something, we really can appreciate the value of what we finally get. And I never had struggled so much in my life as hitchhiking through that Middle East, through these deserts, getting rides on camels and old trucks and walking. Finally, I was there. It was at Ferozpur in Punjab. I gave my passport to the immigration agent. She looked at it. I had a valid visa. Everything was in order. She looked at me and said, "You require minimum $200 to enter India. Show me your money." I had a little cloth bag and I looked through. I remember I had exactly 26 cents in about 5 different currencies. When she saw that, she said, "You are rejected. We have enough beggars. We don't want another one." I pleaded with her. I said, "I risked my life just to try to meet your people and discover the treasures of your culture." I said, "I can't even go back because I only had a one entry into Pakistan. So I wasn't allowed back there. And to hitchhike all the way back was impossible." I was pleading with her. The more I pleaded, the more angry she became. And she stomped her military boot down and said, "Do not test my patience." And the border guards put their guns in my face and said, "Go back." I went back where there was a big neem tree, and I sat under that neem tree praying. And then I went back to the border and pleaded again, and they sent me back. They rejected me for 6 hours. But there was no way I was going to go back. Finally, just before the sunset, the guard changed, and an elderly Sikh gentleman took the post, and she drove off in a jeep. And I went up to him and gave my passport, and he looked at me like I was such a unwanted intruder. He said, "My superior officer has told me that you are rejected. Go back." I started to cry. What else could I do? I wasn't pretending. It was for real. I said, "I have given up everything to find the treasures of your great culture. I promise you, try to do something good for your people. Just give me a chance." He looked at me in my eyes for about 30 seconds. Then he took my passport and stamped it. He put his hand on my head and said, my child," I was 19, but I looked about 16. He said, "My child, find what you are crying for. Welcome to India." I crossed the border. It was by that time night. There were stars. I don't remember the moon. I just remember a lot of stars. And there were just fields. I was just walking through these fields. I didn't know which way to go. Should I go straight, right, left? I was all alone. I didn't know anyone. I didn't have anything. But I felt totally at home. I was so happy, so grateful. Literally, I felt that I was being embraced by my mother. I went to the Himalayas. The first day I was there sitting and meditating on the bank of the Ganga, one sadhu came up to me. I never saw him before. Your Western clothes and put them in the current of Mother Ganga. I only had one set of clothes. Some pants and a shirt. And when you only have one thing, you really become attached to it. It was my identity. But it seems that this person was telling me. So I put my clothes in the Ganga, and he gave me the robes of a sadhu, like this, except white. And I found a cave in the Himalayas to live in. And for 1 month I sat on a rock in the current of the Ganga and meditated, prayed, and mostly just observed Mother Ganga and nature. And incredible lessons were coming to me. At the end of the month, many things happened, and I decided I would start to meet the different holy people, yogis and sages. Some were world famous later on, some were completely unknown. I lived in a cave with one yogi, and he told me that you must stay here with me for the rest of your life. He was a very powerful person. His name was Tatwala Baba. And he used to sit in meditation without moving, sometimes 12 hours. I was sitting next to him. I moved every now and then, though. But I would sit in meditation next to him. He would not open his eyes. He was like this. I was like this. But every now and then I'd go like... He was a very powerful person. And, you know, I was just a little boy. And he had long, matted hair. The only clothes he wore, even in the winter, because I was there in the winter. This was December 1970, I was with him. And he only wore one little strip of burlap as a loincloth, a kopan. So when he told me that I must stay with him for the rest of my life, I was afraid to say no. And I was really honored that he was inviting me. But I understood that I want to see more things and meet more people before I come to such a ultimate decision in my life. But how to explain this to him? So right after about a week went by, I was just about to try to explain him, but I was really very concerned that he might curse me, or something might come out of his eyes and burn me. I didn't know what was going to happen. Just when I was about to speak, he said, "I understand." And I kind of explained to him, and he said, he blessed me and said, "May God be with you." So I left the cave. I crossed the Lakshman Julan Bridge in Rishikesh, and started going north. through the forest, I came to a clearing. What I saw there horrified me. I saw people. Some were naked. Some were in filthy rags. They were so poor. It was now getting toward the spring, but it was still very cold in the Himalayas. Some would bury their body with dirt to keep warm at night. But the worst thing is many of them, they had no fingers, they had no toes, their noses were melting away, their skin was decomposing and deformed. It was a leprosy colony. And in those days, nobody cared for the lepers. They were desperate. They had nothing and no one. And they saw a person with light skin. About 15 of them surrounded me and were screaming, "Bakshish, bakshish!" And they were putting their fingerless hands in my face, demanding bakshish. They wouldn't let me go. A tight circle. And they were fighting with each other to get closer to me, to be the one to get the donation. If I had anything, I would have given them everything, but I had nothing. But they didn't believe me. And as they were screaming, "Bakshish, bakshish," they were spitting in my face and they were putting their hands in my face. Except I heard it was contagious. And I was wondering if I would end up with them. I remember thinking, how terrible it is that they're doing this to me. And then I was thinking, the way that they are suffering and the way that they are completely rejected by the whole of society, anything they do is acceptable. Finally, after about 20 minutes or so, they thoroughly searched me, every part of me, and discovered I actually had nothing. So, the circle dissipated and they all went their own way. I took about 3 steps, and such a sigh of relief. And then about 15 feet to the left of me, what I saw made me stop in my tracks. It was an old leper woman. Half her hair was bald, half was white. Her whole face was deformed. Her nose was just kind of like a bloody mess. No fingers. She was laying on her side. And she kind of got up with her arm. And she looked at me. What I saw in her eyes, what her people did to me. And she felt such deep compassion for me. In her eyes, I could see her begging forgiveness from me from what her people did. And I looked deeper in her eyes, And I saw the love of a mother. I saw in her something that was so deep, the desire to show motherly love to a child, something that she probably had no chance to do for decades. And she was almost pleading with me to accept her affection. She didn't speak English, but it was all in her eyes. Such love, such compassion. I became so moved. I ran over to her. She put out her hand first like this. Actually like this. And then she put out her palm to bless me. And I ran and put my head under her palm. With her palm on top of my head, she said over and over again in Hindi, "May God bless you, my child. May God bless you. May God bless you." And I looked up at her. I was on my knees with my head practically on the ground. And when I looked up, she was smiling. She had no teeth, but she was smiling in ecstasy. And from her eyes, tears were flowing. Tears of joy. The joy of giving. This was one of the greatest transformations of my consciousness in my life at this moment. Because as I looked at her, the ugliest thing physically I have ever seen, I was thinking, she's the most beautiful person I've ever seen. We've all heard the saying, you cannot judge a book by looking at its cover. What is real beauty? In this modern world, people have a tendency for such superficialities. Beauty is something that we see with our eyes. But actual beauty is something we feel with our heart. All she wanted in life was to give someone her love. She wanted nothing in return except for someone to just accept her love. And she gave it unconditionally. It was beautiful. I was looking up at her and I actually saw that she, with my eyes, that she was really beautiful. I thanked her and I walked away and went back to the bank of the river and meditated on this. The Atma, the eternal soul, is seeing through the eyes, hearing through the ears, tasting through the tongue, thinking through the brain, loving through the heart. But it's that living force that's the source of real beauty. Without it, the body's just a dead corpse. But how we have the tendency to be affected by all these weapons of mass distraction within the world. Distracted from our real meaningful existence. That leper woman became one of my prominent gurus at that point in my life. I went higher in the Himalayas and met, he was about 6'5". He was like a mountain himself. He had long matted hair, so long that it went, when he stood up, it went a couple feet on the ground underneath him. He was somewhere around 65 or 70 years old. I was, at least he looked that old. He became a sadhu when he was 12 and roamed the forest alone ever since. His name was Kailash Baba. He carried a big trident and one of those drums that go doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo with the ball that goes doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. He was really scary looking, but he was one of the softest, gentlest, kindest people I ever met. He taught me how to live in the jungle. He taught me which herbs, which leaves, which fruits you can eat and which you should not eat. He taught me where to find medicine. The jungle is like a pharmacy if you understand how it works. You know, I'd get sick and he would just, you know, pull something out of the ground and tell me to eat it. I ate it and I'd get better. He taught me how to live with our neighbors. Neighbors were leopards, wild boar, cobras, vipers, wild elephants, mosquitoes. What he taught me is if you want to survive in the jungle, they are more powerful than you. If you feel superior to them, if you have an ego that I'm better than them, they will kill you. They rule over the jungle. If you see them as your brothers and sisters, without fear, if you respect them, they will respect you and they will never harm you. Now, this was a good lesson. To study and assimilate and maybe, you know, apply it later. But the problem is they were all around me. He was telling me I had to live like this immediately if I want to survive. And you know something? Confidence. Just being with him, I wasn't afraid. When I'd see these animals, I would fearlessly just respect them with confidence that God is in their hearts, just as God is in my heart. He taught me how to beg as an act of integrity. He taught me that to beg as a sadhu is actually to give. You're going to give God's blessings, not to take. So many lessons. He taught me more than I learned in all my schools in America. The amazing thing, he did not speak a word of English. And I didn't speak Hindi. I learned so much from him. With no language. He would just, by his glances, by his pointing, he would speak a language I couldn't understand, but he would speak with certain emphasis so I could actually understand what he was saying. And I learned from him that if a teacher genuinely cares about his student or her student, then that power of caring transmits knowledge and wisdom even greater than the language it's spoken. And I thought back when I was in school of all the teachers I had in America. This was the one that I learned the most from was the one who really cared about me. But it didn't compare to Kailash Baba. After some time, I continued my journey, met so many people, ultimately came down to Varanasi, where I meditated on the burning bodies at the Manikarnika Ghat from sunrise to sunset, trying to understand the nature of death. That was quite a college subject for me. I went to Gaya, Bodh Gaya, and studied Buddhism. Calcutta, I was with Mother Teresa for some time. And then I came all the way to Mumbai to take a meditation course. And then I was planning to go back to the Himalayas. So I took this 10-day meditation course somewhere near Bhuleshwar, in a little factory, actually. The teacher was teaching in this little factory. And I was sitting for about 8 to 10 hours a day in meditation. And after the course was done, I just wanted to walk. I didn't know where I was going to go. But I started walking and walking and walking and walking. I didn't have shoes. And then I came to a stoplight in South Mumbai. And as I was waiting for the light to change, I looked up and I saw this gigantic hoarding that advertised a spiritual festival. And I was interested in everything in spiritual. It was at Cross Maidan. So when I arrived at Cross Maidan, there was this massive tent, a pandal. And in the evening, there was about 20,000 people in that tent. And I was way in the back. Is that music? I was way, way in the back. And there was people performing kirtan on the stage. And the guru came onto the stage. I could hardly see him because I was so far away. But he attracted my heart so deeply. He was walking with such confidence, with such grace. His expression, from what I could see, looked. And he sat on a raised seat. And as others were chanting, there was one man going around taking photographs. And he called that man over. And I saw him speak something in his ear. And then that man, for a few minutes, he was looking out into the crowd. And then he was signaling for someone to come. But no one came. So this man, he came down into the crowd, walked all the way to the back, through thousands and thousands of people, he came right up to me. He was an American man. And he said, "My guru Srila Prabhupada wants you to sit on the stage with him." And I asked, "How does he know me?" He didn't say another word. He just took my hand and pulled me. And I was very pullable in those days. So I just let him pull me, and he pulled me through thousands and thousands of people, and we came to the stage, and he brought me right on the stage and brought me right before Srila Prabhupada, his guru. And Srila Prabhupada smiled, and with folded hands he greeted me. And then he didn't speak, because the kirtan was to sit just about this far away. He deeply moved me. And after the lecture, he invited me. He said, "Every morning I'm speaking in Hindi and every evening in English for the next 14 days. You are welcome to come." So I was there. And I remember in my heart of hearts, something was saying, "This is your guru." But my mind was saying, "No. This cannot be. I cannot make this choice yet." So after the 14-day festival, I said goodbye and went back to the Himalayas, where I lived for some time. Now I'm going to come to a conclusion. I had to go to get a visa extension. And I was going up to Nepal. I lived in Patna for some time. That was very interesting. In Patna, I lived with this Ram Sevak Swami. He lived at the Collectory Ghat on the bank of the Ganga. Some really fascinating stories there. But I'll skip on to the next part. In Nepal, I was living in a place called Swayambhunath, under a tree. And it was the monsoon rain season. So I found a nice tree. And there was a monastery sometimes I'd go in, a Buddhist monastery. One day, I just decided to take a walk. Just like in Mumbai, I had nowhere to go. Sometimes I just get an urge to walk. So I walked through these rice paddies, and I saw something incredible. These rice paddies in Kathmandu Valley were so expansive. There was no houses in those days, there was no trees, just rice paddies as far as the eyes could see in all directions. And I went to Kathmandu and then started going back about 3 miles to Swayambhunath. Big, dark clouds formed in the sky. It started drizzling rain. And I understood that there was going to be a major storm. So I was looking for some shelter because I only had one set of sadhu clothes. There were no trees, there were no houses, but I saw a distance away what appeared to be a little old man with a long beard walking with an umbrella. So I was determined to get under that umbrella. And you know how rice paddies are. In the monsoon seasons, they're thick mud, and there's that little border that you could walk on. So I was walking on the border, I was slipping and trying to stay in the border, and I somehow or other ran up to that person and went really tight behind him. And started raining really hard, and I was under the umbrella, and he was walking, and I was walking right behind him. It was quite incredible. Because we were the only two human beings as far as the eyes could see in the middle of this monsoon rainstorm under one umbrella. We walked for about 15, 20 minutes together. Then the storm stopped. He never turned around. I guess because, you know, he didn't want to fall in the mud. I said, thank you. And for the first time, he turned around. When he saw me, he dropped his umbrella in the mud. His eyes opened, and my eyes opened. It was Gary, my friend. The last I saw him was 1 year before in that cave in Crete. And we had absolutely no communication because I didn't know where he was going and I never had a place to stay and there were no cell phones. We embraced together again. He went to Israel. And he worked on a kibbutz. And then he made money. He was getting paid. And he took a bus, the magic bus, to Delhi. And because it was so hot in Delhi, he and some friends got a house in Kathmandu Valley. And he decided to take a walk that day. We miraculously met. I told him, Gary, you are in India now. I will train you how to be a sadhu. So he became a sadhu with me. And we used to jump on these third-class trains because they were so crowded, ticket collectors couldn't get in. That was the sadhu's way of hitchhiking, because it's free. There's a price, but not in rupees. And I'll end with this little ending. We boarded a train. We went down by truck from Nepal to Gorakhpur and then to Patna. And then we went by third class, showed him the burning ghats, and the Kashi Vishwanath. And I remember I was praying and crying to Kashi Vishwanath. Show me my path. I had met so many gurus and so many religions. I studied Judaism and Christianity in the Middle East. I studied Islam. I studied Tibetan Buddhism, Burmese Buddhism, Zen Buddhism. I studied under Shivites and different types of yogis of different schools. And what is my path? I liked everything and I liked everyone, but I didn't know. I realized I had to follow a path. And I was crying to Kashi Vishwanath, please show me the way. Taking Gary to Amarnath, because there was a big pilgrimage there, and I was told that if you go to Amarnath during this pilgrimage, all your desires will be fulfilled. So I had this desire that God show me my path. So we jumped on a third class train. It was so crowded we could not sit. It was just jam-packed. And we were in this big field and there was a monsoon rainstorm. Field flooded. The train stopped for 20 hours. You know what a traffic jam is like? There's a certain propensity of human beings that we like to move forward. We don't like to be stagnated. Well, we couldn't get out of the train because it was just a lake of mud. And after about 20, 25 hours, finally, the steam engine blew its whistle. And then
was like being liberated. Just hearing that steam engine moving again.
5 o'clock in the morning, we stopped at a station. And Gary and I, we were on our way to the closest place to Amarnath. But we were so thirsty. And we so much wanted to breathe fresh air. And we so much wanted to move. That we crawled out a window of that train. And drank some water and breathed air. And walked around. And after some time, the train started moving. And we tried to get in. But we couldn't get in.
Masses of human bodies. We couldn't get in.
The train was gone. And after everybody left the railway platform, there were just a few sadhus sitting on the ground. And I asked them, "Where am I?" And he said, "This is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace. And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday." And we didn't have anywhere else to go. So we went to see the birthplace. And then I told Gary, I heard about Vrindavan. I said, "I'm going to Vrindavan." And I went there and I roamed around and Gary met me there. And because it was Janmashtami, there were a lot of people. So Gary wanted to leave. So I said, "I'll meet you at the Brahma Ghat in Haridwar. And from there we'll go to Amarnath. I'll meet you there in 4 days. And I was sleeping on the bank of the river Yamuna. And the morning I was supposed to leave, I couldn't move. I had typhoid fever. High fever. Sickest I've ever been in my life. And ultimately Krishna would not allow me to leave Vrindavan. And by the time I got better, I never wanted to leave Vrindavan for the rest of my life. So that's kind of how I became like this. And 6 months later, Srila Prabhupada came to Vrindavan. And there I studied his teachings. And spent nice time with him. And decided I want to help him in this beautiful mission of compassion. One of the themes of this book is my parents. Please try to understand, their little 19-year-old son left home and said he'd be back in 3 months. And 4.5 months later, they got a letter saying I was hitchhiking to India. It was postnacht Iran. And including in the book are my letters to my parents, because they saved them all. And in the end, my mother and father, they started coming here to India and meeting the people. In fact, it was Dr. Desai, who was here a moment ago, who convinced my father to come here. And they were so transformed. When my mother passed away, they did something in the history of my family never happened. They cremated her body and gave me the ashes to put in the Ganges, in the Ganga in India. And in a couple of weeks, my father, who's 89, he'll be coming back to India for Kushal, the Nupur's nephew's cousin's marriage. Forgive me if I spoke too long, but I'm so honored and grateful to have had this opportunity to be with all of you. Thank you very much.